please the court. My name is Robert J. Kiroff. I'm with the firm Kiroff and Lilly in Houston, and I represent Tony Ballone, the husband and the petitioner in this case. This case is a divorce case that was tried by Judge Sam Emerson in Houston a year and a half or so ago. The jurisdiction of this court is based upon a conflict between courts of civil appeal on some important legal issues that are covered in our application for writ of error. The major issue in the trial of this case was whether or not the stock of Tony Restaurant Inc., a Texas corporation organized during the marriage, was the separate property of Tony Ballone or whether it was community property. The case was tried to a judge without a jury over a period of about 2 weeks. The judge found an answer to request for findings, and in fact found in finding the judgment that 47% of the corporation was the separate property of Tony Ballone, and 53% of the corporation was the community property of Tony and Leslie Ballone. The basis for the court's judgment in that regard had to do with the consideration given to the issuance of the stock. The court found that separate consideration was given for 47% of the stock, and community consideration was given for the balance. The court then proceeded to partition the community estate. There was a little quarrel as to what the percentage of the partition was. We have asserted that the wife got 60% and the husband 40. I believe that the wife says no, that the husband got 51% and the husband 49%. Suffice it to say that the partition is relatively equal. The partition is relatively equal in spite of the fact that Tony Ballone was awarded primary custody of the two sons of this marriage. The partition was relatively equal in spite of the fact that Tony Ballone was ordered to pay over $1 million in debt, whereas the wife received her share of the assets relatively free of debt. The case was appealed by the wife, and she asserted a number of points of error in the Court of Civil Appeals. The Court of Civil Appeals affirmed everything that the trial court had done, with the sole exception of the partition. The Court of Civil Appeals severed all issues except the partition issue, affirmed all issues except the partition issue, and remanded the case back to the trial court to reconsider the partition of the community estate between the two parties. Why did the Court of Civil Appeals do that? It's perfectly clear in the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals that the Court of Civil Appeals believed that the trial court had abused its discretion. How? By failing to consider the increase in the value of Tony's Restaurant Inc. attributable to the labor and the effort of Tony Ballone. That was the announced reason for the winner. The court even went further than that and pointed out, had it not been for the accretion, the increase, and the value of the separate property portion of the restaurant, that the partition would have been fair and there would have been no remand. The main points that I would like to argue to this court this morning are these. Can it be error, and can a trial court be reversed for failing to consider an issue that was not pled, that was not proven, that was not the subject of a request for a finding of fact or a conclusion of law, that was not a point of error made in the brief filed in the Court of Civil Appeals? Can it be error for a trial court to fail to consider an issue that was not covered by any of those procedures? I will further argue that, in fact, the trial court did consider the increase in the value of the separate property portion of the restaurant. But during the first portion of my argument, I am going to assume that the Court of Civil Appeals was correct and that the trial court indeed did not consider the increase in the value of the separate property.
Counsel, somewhere in your argument, as I understand the rule, this is a divorce case and we have no jurisdiction except in the case of a conflict or dissenting opinion.
Yes.
And help me with conflict as you go, please.
Yes, sir, I will.
Things in conflict with Hale.
The conflict has to do with whether or not in Texas The community is entitled to be compensated for the labor performed by one of the spouses that benefits the separate property of that spouse. The Hale case, which is a recent case, held that in Texas, community labor performed so as to enhance and increase the value of the separate estate of the other spouse is not entitled to reimbursement or compensation. In that case, a husband, who apparently was a skilled craftsman, spent a lot of time, I believe over $200 was his testimony, improving the separate residence of the wife. The marriage dissolved, the husband claimed that he had not been compensated for any of that work, but as a result of that work, the separate property of the wife had increased in value, had enhanced in value. And he asked that the community, that city, be compensated for the fair value of his toil and his labor, and that he then get his pro rata share of that compensation. The Hale Court pointed out that in Texas, the rule for reimbursement is that you're entitled to the cost of the improvement or the amount that the improvement enhances the separate estate, whichever is the smaller. I believe Hale was correct in its approach to the problem. Hale, however, went on to say that when labor is involved rather than the use of money, there is no cost. Since the measure is cost or enhanced value, and since labor involves no cost, no reimbursement. That's the holding of Hale. It's in direct conflict with what the Court of Civil Appeals said in this case, that the labor of Tony Malone, to the extent that it increased the value of the separate estate, gave rise to a claim on the part of the community and therefore the wife for some kind of compensation, some kind of reimbursement. But that is the issue central to this case. What are the rights that the community may have if one of the members of the community toils and labors, and that toil and labor results in an increase in the value of that marital partner's separate estate?
Is labor defined anywhere? Do you mean physical labor? If a husband, for example, in another case, was a skilled stockbroker, and he listened and everybody listened, and he took his wife's separate property, increased 10 times by his labor. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, sir, I think that would be one of the things that we're talking about, and that very case is arisen in California, and the case decided in Mabry. The intriguing thing about this whole issue is that there is virtually no law on the subject in Texas. If you look at the...
There's no law, we've got a conflict problem, which is not my point.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, in order to narrow this, as I understand it, one spouse is entitled to reimbursement if he takes from his fund and actually puts cash into it and buys materials. What we're really talking about is reimbursement for cash advance for the spouse's estate as distinguished from labor and talent.
Precisely. Now, I would like to take the position with this court this morning that Hale is correct, and that when a marital partner labors for the benefit of his separate estate, and that labor actually results in an increase in the value of the separate estate, that Hale is correct and no reimbursement is appropriate. I cannot, with any objective honesty, take that position with this court this morning. But I am going to assume, for the benefit of the purpose of this argument, that Hale is incorrect, and that the labor of marital partners and the fruit of that labor belongs to the community. If it's diverted to the separate estate of the laboring partner, I'm going to assume that the community is entitled to reimbursement in some fashion or some form. Now, I would like to suggest to this court that the problem is identical, Your Honor, with the advance of cash money. There is nothing in logic, there is nothing in the law that would suggest that we ought to treat the expenditure of community money for the benefit of one separate estate any differently than we should treat the expenditure of community labor for the benefit of one separate estate. There isn't any legal distinction. There isn't any logical or rational distinction, in my humble opinion. Now, it's true that in the case of money being expended, the cost is readily apparent. How much money was expended? When the labor is expended, you've got to quantify its value, which is an easily achieved task in this day and age. If a carpenter works 200 hours on a house, it's not very difficult to prove out what the value of that labor was and is. Now, I would like, therefore, to suggest to the court the law in Texas on the advance of money, community money, to improve separate property is very clear and very well established and has been for a long number of years. Among the things that the case law tells us about the advance of cash, community cash, for the benefit of one separate estate, is that, first of all, it must be pledged. You must prove what the amount of the advance was and how much the property was enhanced as a result of the advance. The pleadings in the Malone case are some of the best pleadings I've seen in 23 years. It's a remarkable instrument. The most detailed divorce pleading I've ever observed. It isn't a two-page pleading or one that was cursorily done. It's apparent somebody spent a lot of time in that. And in fact, in the pleading, there is a claim for reimbursement for money advanced by the community estate to the separate property business. No mention of any community labor having been expended. So there isn't any pleading that raises this issue in this case. There would have to be a pleading if community cash had been advanced. Lindsay versus Clayman, Burton versus Bell, all the cases say that. And I suggest to you that the advance of community labor no less requires a pleading than the advance of community cash. Secondly, if community cash is advanced, it's got to be proven. Somebody's got to take the witness stand and say how much cash was expended. And further, somebody needs to take the witness stand to tell the court or the jury how much that cash improves the separate estate, because again, the amount of reimbursement is the cost or the enhanced value, whichever is the lesser. Not a smidgen of evidence in this case as to the value of the labor given, or to what extent the restaurant was improved by reason of that labor as distinguished from the many other factors that might have caused the restaurant to increase in value. In any question, but that this stock increased in value. None. But was it because of inflation over this 11-year period, location, price adjustment, the personal goodwill of Tony Malone? This court, in the Colvin case, cited in our outline, spoke to that sort of issue and had no difficulty saying that the record was devoid of that kind of information and the determination simply couldn't be made. The burden is upon the person asserting reimbursement. The law is clear on that subject. The third thing that one must prudently improve, when money is advanced from the community to improve the separate estate, is that there wasn't any corresponding quid pro quo back from the separate estate to the community estate. Because reimbursement is allowable only to the extent that the expenditure exceeds the benefit received back. And that is at the guts of this particular case in California and Idaho and Washington and in practically all other community property jurisdictions. The inquiry in a case of this sort is, was the laboring spouse fairly and adequately compensated for his services? If he was not, the damages are to reimburse the community for what the fair value of those services should have been. If he was fairly compensated for the services, there is no reimbursement. Now, it may be argued, and it has been argued, that when a marital partner labors for separate property, that in some fashion or form, the separate property ought to be converted in whole or in part to community property. I suggest to the court that again, a long line of Texas cases instruct us that the character of property is fixed at the time of inception, and that you can do all kinds of things subject thereto, and it doesn't affect the character of property. For instance, if a man owns separate property and spends $10 million improving it, and the $10 million is advanced out of the community estate, it doesn't change the fact that the land is a separate property. It continues to be a separate property. And this court has said so over and over again. The claim is for reimbursement, for money, and does not create an interest in the land, not even an equitable interest in the land. It's a money claim, and it's a money claim for reimbursement, and the measure again intent is the amount of money expended, cost, or the enhanced value, whichever is the lesser. When you add up all of the legal requirements, pleading, proof, etc., then what has been required had this been a claim for reimbursement for cash advance? And if the court agrees with me that the test for labor advance ought to be the same, the court will conclude, as I have, that this record is totally deficient in the pleading and in the proof that would have been required to properly make the claim that has been asserted. And further, the failure to request findings and conclusions on this point and the failure to raise it by a proper point in the appellate brief makes clear that a reversal on this issue, this unfled issue, this issue that was not preserved on appeal, is simply incorrect and wrong. Now, I have been assuming thus far that the trial court did indeed fail to consider the increment in the value. I should mention that while 53% of the residence was determined by the court to be community property, the trial court awarded 70% of that 53% to the wife as part of her share of the community estate, so that the wife disproportionately shared in the increase in the value of that residence compared to the husband. The wife having received 70% of the community portion, the wife having received only 30%. The Court of Civil Appeals emphasizes in a couple of places that the trial court failed to consider the increase in the value of this separate property, this 47% separate property difference. The record is crystal clear to the contrary. In fact, the wife filed a motion for reconsideration prior to the entry of judgment. Among the things that she alleged in her motion for reconsideration is that Judge Emerson had failed to consider the increase in the 47% separate property interest that had been created by his time, his toil, his talent. That's what the motion said, motion to reconsider, and one of the grounds was the very point that we're talking about this morning. The court, in fact, considered it, as the transcript shows, and a month later signed its judgment. So it is absolutely beyond dispute that the trial court did indeed consider the very point that the Court of Civil Appeals said it did not consider. The transcript is clear. This case involves an issue that has been floating around in Texas for a long time. You can't attend a family law seminar, you can't pick up a family law journal, when everybody in the world in Brighton on this subject has some different point of view. I know this court is not in the business of resolving problems because they exist, but rather in resolving problems that arise from errors of lower court. But I would respectfully request and suggest that if there's any way the court can write on this subject, it will benefit a whole bunch of people in this state, not just lawyers and judges. Thank you very much.
Counsel, let me ask you
a question.
What do the out-of-state cases say as to the toil and labor enhancement?
California has been the leader in this particular area. And in California, there are two rules. One is called the Van Camp Rule, based on the trial of the case, and it's attached to my supplemental brief. And the other is the Pariah Rule, also attached to my brief. The Van Camp Rule is that if a marital partner labors for the benefit of the separate estate and is adequately compensated for his labor, there is no claim for reimbursement. Because to reimburse again would be double compensation. If the wife receives the benefit of the compensation while the labor is being performed, it is to be compensated a second time on down the line as double compensation. That's the Van Camp Rule. The Pariah Rule says that if a husband, let's assume it's the husband, labors for a separate property business, he will be awarded as his separate property a, quote, fair return on whatever his separate property investment was, based on the money market situation at the time. And the balance of the business will be treated as community property. That's called a pariah rule. The Van Camp rule is the one that is followed in 90% of the cases. And by the way, California Supreme Court in the Dean case attempted to reconcile those divergent rules and said that trial courts can apply one or the other depending on what justice requires in any given case. But when you read the California cases, it's apparent that in 99.9% of the cases, Van Camp is applied. In the other community property jurisdictions, most of the other ones, Idaho, Washington, New Mexico, the Van Camp rule is applied without any question. That is, that the laboring spouse, if he's fairly compensated, that's the end of it. If he's not fairly compensated, then the community is entitled to reimbursement to the extent of fair compensation from the separate state, and that's the end. And that's the rule that I'm advocating, it's the enlightened rule, and the rule that I believe Texas should adopt.
Well, man, as I see this case, here is a husband who has labored. He's enhanced the value of his separate estate. But didn't the wife enjoy the benefits of this along the way? She kind of probably lived pretty high off the hog.
That's precisely the point, Your Honor, that the wife, in the last couple of years, Tony was taking out his salary, $200,000 a year, and we proved up his salary for a long period of time, and his salary was pretty healthy. And indeed, that money came into the community estate, it was expended to acquire community assets, to live very well indeed, and that was the point I was making earlier. She received, because of the compensation for those labors, all of the benefits that the compensation allowed her to enjoy. And now to come back in a second time and say we're going to compensate you again because incidental to that labor, the separate portion of this record increased in value. We don't know from this record whether the labor caused the increase or any of the other factors that might have, but even assuming that labor was a part of that increase, if it was fairly paid for, adequately compensated for, you can take this case and extrapolate it to any number of other cases, the ranchers.
Well, Judge Castle, just to be devil's advocate, all the time Tony's making this $200,000, his wife is keeping him real well. She gets up and she does the house, she cleans the kids, and she gets Tony to work every morning, feed him like $1 million so he can make $1 million. Now, is it a double dip? Because she's contributed and he's contributed?
Well, I think that that's why we give her certain community interest in the compensation he receives as he brings the paycheck home each month. But Judge, it's like the old boy whose daddy leaves him a ranch. It's a separate property ranch. And he goes out in the morning and milks the cows and plows the fields and so on. That ranch is going to go up in value. We all know that. He could work 15 hours a day and his wife can work 20 hours a day and the ranch is going to go up in value. But when they sell their calf, that's community income and they flip the profit. When they harvest their wheat crop.
I was just wondering about your double dip example.
Yes, sir. Well, I think it is a double dip because she's being compensated twice instead of one time.
She's being compensated the first time for her own labor, perhaps.
Well, if the record suggested that, for instance, if the wife, in fact, worked for this restaurant, that might be a different case.
But she works for the family. That's fair.
Well, yes. Now, I understand the point you're making. But you see, How many times does labor have to be compensated before we achieve justice? And these questions, as I say, are all discussed in some considerable detail by the United States cases, and I really recommend those to your reading because they've grappled with this problem for 25 or 30 years, and the law in those states in this area is very well developed as an outline. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Counsel. Court will take a brief recess.
About
all the laws there is to bring to bear on the issue or issues of this case that have been presented in one way or another with pretty much the full analysis of all the approaches used by the various jurisdictions and courts to resolve the issue before this court. In my review analysis of these cases and articles, I came away not with the impression that there were any hard and fast principles to be applied unwaveringly in all instances. Instead, it clearly appeared to me that in each case, the various courts were endeavoring to approach or apply or use whatever approach that they felt like would achieve justice under particular fact circumstances. I have brought copies with me of one additional article, which I do not believe has been cited to this court. The article is by Mr. Weekly and is derived from and more fully developed the outline, which is Appendix 5 in the application for writ of error. And I have brought copies in the read the court. I'd like to leave copies with the clerk for the court to view. After reviewing many of the same cases that have been cited to this court, Mr. Weekly concluded that regardless of which approach should be used by the court, that the characterization of appreciated business property will have to be done on a case-by-case basis. Now, it's my understanding from Ms. Farrell's argument and from their brief that they are suggesting to this court that what has been referred to as the Van Camp rule, that being a reimbursement by way of adequate salary or compensation, is the only approach that should be applied in Texas. And in response to that, I mean, it's important to look at the facts and the factors of these other cases that have been cited and compare them with the facts and factors of this particular case. Just briefly, I think the factors of particular significance in this case are beginning with the fact that the parties were married in 1966. The restaurant was acquired during the marriage and was initially operated as a sole proprietorship prior to being incorporated. Apparently, from the testimony of Mr. Ballone and his witnesses, there was no initial cash investment or capitalization in the restaurant. Instead, the separate asset consisted of used furniture, some used equipment, and used leasehold improvements. And they were assigned a value by the court based on tax returns, depreciated value on tax returns of some $9,365. The restaurant is a, I think everybody would agree, a service-oriented business, and is essentially a one-man or a dominant personality business.
Does the record show where it is?
Where the restaurant is? I would show you, it's in Houston on the south coast of.
Is that in the Galleria area?
No, sir. I think it's in what they call the Magic Circle area in Houston. It's right outside the west loop on South Coast. I guess it's in the Galleria area. It's north of the Galleria, just a few blocks away.
I think it's not an inexpensive place.
No, sir. I don't frequent the restaurant very often. Sure, the exact location. I have been there once. As I was saying, I think that Tony Ballone is asking the court to rule the prominent facts of this case, including those that I just specified, that because he was paid a good salary for his efforts, that all of the increase in the value of the 47%, which was found to be his separate stock initially, should remain and be accorded to him as his separate property. And I just don't believe the facts and factors of this case are in accord with the facts and factors of the cases relied upon by the petitioner for his position. Ms. Farrell talked briefly about the Van Camp case and Van Camp rule. In that case, the husband was 54 years old at the time of the marriage. The wife in that case was 21 years old at the time of the marriage. At the time of the marriage, the husband was already a wealthy, well-to-do man of large financial means, and was the president and manager of the Van Camp Seafood Company prior to the time of the marriage. The marriage lasted for less than 4 years. The corporation, as I said before, was organized before the marriage with a capital of $200,000. And Mr. Van Camp, during the 4 years, somewhat less than 4 years of marriage, owned 75% of the stock. Well, those facts are just not analogous to the facts of the case that is before this court today. I think it's also an interesting case that they relied on an earlier case cited in that opinion, the estate of Pepper, which held the crops grown on separate property remaining separate, regardless of the fact it was a community labor and effort that in large part produced those crops. And that is in direct conflict with the early cases in Texas. The Gilmore case, which is also a California case cited by petitioner, this again was a relatively short marriage, 6-year marriage. The husband owned 3 incorporated automobile dealerships prior to the time of the marriage. The corporation was fully staffed by personnel who was capable of carrying on the business unassisted. The husband, in the Gilmore case, worked short hours at long vacations, not like Mr. Malone in this case, who's been 100% through his effort, comes into town at this restaurant, building the restaurant. And in addition to that, in the Gilmore case, during the time involved, this was back in 1965, if I'm not mistaken, there was a tremendous increase in automobile business, which corresponded to a tremendous increase in the value of automobile dealerships at that point in time. A general economic force causing an increase, as opposed to the time, talent, and labor of the husband. In the Bean versus Bank of America, as Mr. Tiro also mentioned, the increase in value of such a property in that case was from $1,630,000 to $1,851,000. And this was a 29 to 30 year marriage, and yet the increase, not an annual increase, but the total increase in separate estate amounted to only 13.5%. And I think that that's a very important distinguishing factor from the case that we had before this court. The California Supreme Court in the Bean case clearly indicated that there is an alternative approach to Van Camp, that being the Pereira approach, giving a fairly sound investment on such a property, with the balance of the increase being allocated to the community. And on page 261 of the Bean opinion, the court stated with approval the following: the court is not bound either to adopt a predetermined percentage of the fair return on business capital with the separate property, that being the Pereira approach, nor need it limit the community interest only to a salary fixed as a reward for a spouse's service, that being the Van Camp approach, but may select whichever formula will achieve substantial justice between the parties.
Counsel, that right there is one of the things that concerns me. Assume that we agree that everything is right, that the law is the way you want it to be and assert it to be. In a situation where the trial court found that 53% was community, and then the trial court gave the wife 70% of that, is not the thing we have to do is to say that that was an abuse of discretion, that he should have given her more than 70%.
I think, Your Honor, that the burden that we have on appeal is the abuse of discretion with regard to the division of property. I don't think that in any case it particularly needs to be centralized on the division of one particular asset. In this case, there were other assets.
But this was the approach the trial judge used. He could have used a different approach. I'm agreeing with you on that. But this is the approach he used. And he gave her 70% of the community, and he gave Mr. Malone 30%. And she says that she should have got more, and the trial court abused his discretion.
Well, in limiting it to the one asset, in my view of the case, Your Honor, to give her 70% or 53% sounds like there's something pretty substantial being done, but what that amounts to is a little over 30% being set aside to...
amounts to 37%.
37%.
Point one.
Being set aside to Mrs. Malone, just being an asset that was started, acquired during marriage was capitalized with some used equipment and leasehold improvements that amounted to some $20,000 in value. That during the marriage, as a result, I think adequately shown in the transcript, an increase to $1 million is found by the top court by the community, time, talent, call, and labor. To me, I think it is an abuse of discretion to set aside an asset like this that has been built during marriage, that is a major income producing property of the community estate, to divide in the matter with the wife.
Let us suppose that Mr. Malone was given this $20,000 worth of stock, that he and his wife never went into the place, and they spent all their time traveling. But through good management by people they hired, this value went up to $2 million. In that situation, it would still be his separate property, would it not? Because he had not contributed anything.
I agree with you.
And that would be true even if the original furniture in the place was worth only $9,000.
Take issue with that, Your Honor. I think it's possible one could say that it was due to the husband's talent in managing time and bringing in good people around him that might have helped produce the increase. But I think that what Your Honor is saying pretty well accords with the Gilmore case, for example, that I talked about, where there was an increase in value. In that case, the husband didn't really work at it, or he worked 4 hours and was gone on vacation. And in that case, it was more. According to Gilmore, said that justice would be achieved by the fact that he received an adequate compensation for the work that he did. However, that's an important distinction in the that we have. The husband in this case completely built the restaurant. We sat and listened to testimony for 3 days and in trial from new witnesses that Tony Malone was the restaurant. The restaurant was what it was today because of Tony Malone and his talent. Like me, that they're trying to have the case needed too in that regard, which I don't blame, except when it's creating an equity of my client, to say, on one hand, Tony built the restaurant, it's because of his efforts, he was the one that did it. The reason they're giving that evidence is for goodwill purposes on evaluation, and now on the other hand, to say, oh, but now, on this other issue, Tony's efforts really had nothing to do with the increasing value of the restaurant. Not a problem for a maintenance system. And I think it's clear by their own testimony that it was Tony's time, effort, and labor that made the restaurant what it is today. And that time and effort is a community asset.
My concern with the Court of Civil Appeals judgment may not even be raised, but seems to me that the Court of Civil Appeals has placed the trial court in an impossible situation. All the writings, including very recent writings of this court, emphasize that the trial court in dividing the property is to consider a number of elements. But yet the Court of Civil Appeals judgment has affirmed all of this rather complex property division except one item and sends it back to the trial court. And maybe the trial court in making this division was looking at the $1 million debt and was looking at the amount that was to be paid. I don't see how a trial court can try this one item of property division under Article 3 of the 6-3 of the Family Code.
Your Honor, it's my understanding that the entire division of the estate has been remanded for new trial.
I misunderstood. I thought they just affirmed everything and just remanded it.
I think they affirmed everything with regard to granting the divorce, the provision with regard to the service of the children, and other issues that need to be resolved in any divorce case of this type. But the given land for new trial and trial court, the entire division of the estate department.
Well, counsel, that there's no real assurance that you're going to come out as well for your client when you go back as you have up to now, is it?
No, sir, it's not.
But y'all are willing to take that gamble?
Yes. Several other cases that I can give a little quickly talk about. A reasonable rate of return. I think it's important to note in this case that the annual, and I'm not talking about the total rate of return of 11 year married, in this case 10-11 year married, but the annual rate of return involved on an increase in value value of $9,365 to $470,000, that means $47.5 million. Is about 43% annual rate of return. Mine does a staggering rate of return, and certainly cannot be said to be reasonably expected in the type of investment, the type of asset that we use to capitalize this investment by being new funds. It's not a reasonable rate of return, it's an excessive rate of return. Time that the community state is one that has suffered, or is the state that suffers in that regard. Real briefly, the Simplot case has been cited with the Idaho case, and that's a case that turns out that the real corporation interest the husband only owned 8.4%. Spear versus Clement in Idaho, I thought it was interesting when the court remanded that case for new trial, as they of course indicated that the trial court should consider alimony to adjust inequities, and the court well knows we don't have that approach in Texas to adjust inequities. Hamlin versus Molino, which is a Washington case. Interesting, from that case, the appellant cited a case filed in Buchanan and supported his position that the increase in value of such a public corporation was community. And the court, in refusing to use Buchanan as controlling, made the following distinction. In Buchanan, the corporation increased 20-fold in 10 years, in the 10-year period, largely through the personal efforts of the husband. That's the same type of situation we have in the case before this court. In Buchanan, the corporation was formed in large measure by community credit. It's undisputed that community credit was used in the building of this restaurant. In Buchanan, the husband and wife treated the corporate property generalized as community property. And in Buchanan, the original separate investment was almost insignificant as compared to the value of the property at the wife's death in that particular case. That's the same type of factors we have in this case. And I think that according to Hamlin case, had been confronted with the fact that we have in the Bologna that they would have decided that they would have used a different approach. Also, an awesome case example is the California case where the business was a one-man business and where the equipment was essential, but not a real contribution to capital. The court held that even if the corporation was separate, at the time of the corporation, it could be attributable to the community by virtue of time, talent, and labor of the public. And often case is a post-Bancamp case, not a post-Bancamp case, and a post-Carrera case also.
Talking about carpentry in this case. We're talking about Tony Bologna,
who is a unique individual, who is married to Leslie Malone, who built this restaurant through his unique talent and labor, which are attributable to the community. And I don't think it's so easy to put a number on what would be an adequate salary for somebody like Tony Malone. I can't, in my mind, if somebody is working for themselves, if they own 100% of the corporation and they're working for themselves, and the effort that they put forward to the community, then the correct compensation for that effort is what that effort produces.
What did Tony's father contribute? Did he give him the restaurant? Did he give him the
that money? That was Tony Malone's testimony. He said he gave him the restaurant. What we determined was that what he gave to him was some used equipment, some leasehold improvements, tables.
Yep.
Yes.
Did he give him the location?
They had a lease. And the location was given to him, but it's not the same location where the restaurant is located today.
And it was in the form of corporate stock, I believe, wasn't it?
No, it was a sole proprietorship at that time. You know.
It was.
Incorporated later during the marriage, but...
Yes. Tony testimony, they were married in 1956, and according to Tony Malone's testimony, he received the restaurant as a gift in January of 1969, and then the restaurant was incorporated in August of 1969.
Counsel, my problem with the case is, maybe you can help me, no matter which figures you take about the percentage of the total estate that each of the parties got, each of them got within a couple of points of 50%. How can we say that the trial court abused its discretion in making such award, even if they did it on the wrong theory?
I think the abuse of discretion, assuming that the rest of the estate is 53%, of the restaurant of the community, and add that with all the rest of the community assets. And that fund of assets was divided in 50-50, to use your analogy. I think the abuse of discretion is the fact that there was $470,000 in value of an asset that shouldn't be attributable to the community, or $460,000. That increase in value should be attributable to the community that should have been considered in making the division of the community's assets.
Granted that it would be very helpful for the court to write in this area of such interest. Return to my original question to the counsel for the petition. If this is a question of abuse of discretion, where is our conflict?
Well, Your Honor, my response, my motion to dismiss the application for writ for one jurisdiction, that was precisely my point. If it is an abuse of discretion, I don't believe that there is conflict. I think in essence that's what the Court of Civil Appeals did in their judgment, was to find the use of discretion. They said that the increase in value should be taken into consideration. They didn't give any guidelines at all as to should be in the form of reimbursement, should be in the form of having this entire increase attributable to the community and have an actual community interest or right to that. I think that the distinction needs to be made. When you talk about reimbursement, you talk about an equitable claim. And my experience with equitable claims in the trial courts on divorce cases has not been all that good. I talk about equitable reimbursement for money expended in fraud of a spouse's rights. Somebody goes out to Las Vegas and spends $9,000 of community money. If those monies were expended in fraud of the other spouse's rights, does she have an equitable claim that the court may take into consideration? And I think that we need to have a little bit stronger situation to achieve that commitment to where we're not limited to just a practical claim for reimbursement, but there's actually a community right or a community interest in the increase of these local health corporations under the circumstance where that increase is then promulgated solely or in most part by the community time and place.
Counsel, what about the pleadings in
this case?
What about the pleadings?
Mr. Carroll points or stated, of course, that we did have a pleading for reimbursement, but it was only for money. My reading of that pleading for reimbursement is money and property. I think that there is property rights in the community time and labor. So I think that the pleadings are covered in that. I think that there's, it's undisputed that there was an increase in value in the restaurant from the time it was incorporated during the marriage to the time of the divorce. And I think that the evidence clearly shows, beyond a shadow of a doubt in my mind, that the increase in value was due, at least in large part, to the community, time, talent, and labor. So that there were pleadings, there was evidence undisputed, there was an increase in value. I think the increase in value was a result of the community, time, and labor. I think community compensated properly or had a tax, the proper type of interest in that increase, so the community can reach the tax.
Well, how do we tie that? I don't understand how we tie together. It looks like to me it's some speculation as to how much his time and effort were worth if you're looking at it from an hourly standpoint, unless you just compute how much the business has increased in value and then divide that by years or weeks or months or whatever and come up with an average amount.
I think that brings us to the problem as soon as we get to the problem of what do we do. And I think that what I would suggest the court do, what I think that it would be a proper approach, would be to, in cases where there is a Postal Health Corporation that's owned wholly by one of the spouses, and where that spouse devotes 100% of his time and effort to that business, if he can initially rebut the community presumption, but in instances where there is has been this increase in value, I think at that point in time there should be a presumption attached that the increase is community. And from that standpoint, or from that point, I think that the burden should be on the spouse claiming the separate property to demonstrate to the court that the increase in value or some part of it has been or has resulted from something other than time, talent, toil, and labor of the spouse. And you can do this by showing what would be a reasonable rate of return.
Well, now, counsel, you were the plaintiff in the court below, were you not?
Respondent. Oh, I'm sorry, in the trial court?
In the trial court.
We were the respondent.
You were the respondent.
Yes.
I see.
Well, counsel, is your client going to continue to benefit if Tony doesn't die or get sick? He's going to be out there working on the same number of hours, and this value is going to continue to go up, and she's going to benefit from that, perhaps get dividends?
No, Your Honor, what the property did was to set aside to Mrs. Malone a amount of 37.1% interest in the restaurant, and then ordered the restaurant to redeem her stock from her, and that was done by, I think, $7,000, so instead of $7,000 cash at the time of the granting of the divorce, with the remaining $300,000 being paid to her in annual increments of $50,000 each over a 6-year period at 9%. So Mrs. Malone not only doesn't benefit from what the trial court has done, but I think that is additionally credited because the major asset that she got out of the trial court, that being $300,000, was then turned around and used to supply Tony Malone with cheap money to continue to subsidize his restaurant. And he pays her 9% in this day and time on the money that had been set aside to her by the trial court. I think this is an additional area that I think is an abuse of discretion. I think what the Court of Civil Appeals did in looking at the entire record and all the facts involved, that they didn't think that the division was fair. And I think they thought it was so unfair and so unjust to result in abuse of discretion. And that was the reason that while affirming the rest of the issues to be resolved, they felt that the division property should be remanded to the trial court for a new trial.
I take it this was a no-fault divorce.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, that at the time of trial, I think that it was stipulated that it would be a no-fault divorce. I think we're going to end that situation. Mr. Piro stated that he thought it was crystal clear that the trial court did consider...
Counsel, finish your sentence, but you neglected to see the written.
Oh, I'm
go ahead and finish your sentence, please.
That the trial court did consider the increase in value, and in their briefs they cited the finding by the trial court that the profits from the restaurant have been used to benefit the community. I can read what the court's finding is. But when I see that what the court ruling has done is turn around and say that all the profits that have been earned by the corporation have been reinvested in the corporation, and that in essence 63 cents for every one of those dollars could accrue to Tony through the 47% and the portion of the community we've got, I don't think that the wealth part of that is correct.
The rebuttal argument from the petitioner.
I'd like to answer the contingent concern that Mr. Chief Justice has about the conflict in this case. And
we recently had a case involving a telephone company in San Antonio which turned on the question of conflict or not. We've got probably the same rules in every case.
Absolutely. I'd like to point out that what the court did, the Court of Civil Appeals did in this case, is to reverse the trial court because the trial court failed to consider the increase in the value of separate property that resulted from labor. In the Hale case, the Court of Civil Appeals held that a trial court could not consider and could not recompense or pay back or anything community labor. So in the Hale case, they say community labor is entitled to nothing. In the Malone case, they say that community labor is entitled to consideration that results in the non-laboring spouse getting more property. That's the main conflict between Hale and Malone. In addition, we point out in our application that in the Faulkner case, cited in our brief, the court held that there wasn't any reimbursement for labor unless the value of the labor exceeded the salary. In the Malone case, while we urge the court in a couple of three different briefs, please tell us what part compensation for labor plays in this decision. So if we have to go back to the trial court will know what to do. But the court refused to even mention that Tony Malone had been handsomely compensated. Now, in that regard, we put on two or three expert witnesses and inquired of them what somebody in Tony's position could be expected to make. And the answer was the same, $75,000-$80,000. That was the fair value for what Tony was doing at that restaurant, according to some very experienced experts. That wasn't our burden at all, but we put on that evidence, and it was unrefuted. In fact, I'm confident it was accepted by the briefs that had been filed by the Office of Justice. Mr. Payne suggests that there ought to be some sort of a varying approach to the problem. I want to suggest to the court that there isn't any varying approach to the problem when cash money is expended by the community that results in the separate property increasing in value. The rule there is absolutely rigid and set in concrete. What you have to plead, what you have to prove, and what you're entitled to if you plead and prove. No varying approach there. This court in the Colden case was asked to come up with a varying approach. In the Colden case, this court was asked to rule that in some cases you would be entitled to reimbursement in money, and in other cases, perhaps you'd be entitled to an interest in the property itself by reason of the expenditure of money. And the court in the Colden case held that if that kind of rule was imposed by the Supreme Court, it would require litigation in almost all instances in order to determine the real ownership thereof. That's one of the compelling reasons why, when we're dealing with the ownership of property, that we can't have a wishy-washy approach. We've got to know at all times who owns property. That's why Texas has been so strong with its concession of title rule. We've got to know who owns property today, tomorrow, next week. If who owns property depends on the profits made today and tomorrow and yesterday and last year, we will never know who owns the property at any given time without litigation. And I think that's the reason why the courts in other jurisdictions, as the court will see if the reason of those opinions, has been reluctant to apply two varying approach because we need to know who owns the property. And by the way, Justice Greenhill, the restaurant is in the Galleria area, right plump in the middle of Galleria area. Now, if I understand Mr. Payne correctly, he's suggesting that community labor, without any proof that it contributed to the increase in the value of the separate asset, and without any pleading to suggest that, ought to convert what was clearly set the property into community property. When you boil his argument down, that's what he wants this court to do, to adopt a conversion rule without any proof and without any plea. But even assuming proof and plea, as this court held in the Megamire case and for a brief period in the Campbell case, we have a constitution in Texas that fixes rather severely and rather clearly what is separate property and what is community property. What Mr. Payne is suggesting, that in spite of Article 16, Section 15, that we ought to convert what everybody apparently now admits as separate property into community property on some minimalist theory of labor and toil and effort. Now, if this rule is applied, it doesn't stop with residents in Houston, Texas. It applies to the old boy with the ranch that works every day, 7 days a week. It may apply to the guy that buys a 54 Corvette and spends every Sunday polishing it and changing the plugs or whatever you do to Corvette. It's got a rather far-reaching impact, not just the residents. And
I understand.
Yes, sir.
In asset involved corporate stock.
Yes, sir.
Corporate not a restaurant.
Well, the corporation in turn operates and owns
the restaurant. No real estate asset.
No, sir. No real estate. We're dealing with separate from. We're dealing with stock. Now, Mr. Payne, as I say, continues to emphasize that it was the labor of Tony Malone that made this restaurant valuable. Saying it doesn't make it so. The Court of Civil Appeals said the same thing, that the labor of Tony Malone made this restaurant valuable. Not a word of evidence in the record about that. Not a soul. It's a conclusion without any evidence to back it up of any kind. Now, Mr. Payne attached to his most recent brief in this court an opinion from the Attorney General of the State of Texas back in 1945 involving the issue of whether or not a separate property corporation continued to be separate if the husband used it to make all of his acquisitions during marriage. And in that case, that's what the husband did. He didn't buy anything outside of the corporation. He bought everything within the separate property corporation. And the Attorney General ruled, in effect, that that was fraudulent conduct on the part of the husband. You can't use a separate property corporation to shelter and husband under the separate property corporate shell what otherwise would have been community assets. And it's interesting to observe in this case that nobody has ever accused Tony Malone of that kind of practice. And in fact, he didn't follow that kind of practice. Everything he acquired that was not directly associated with the residence as a community asset of himself and Leslie. The property on which Tony Greston sits was leased personally by Tony Malone from Jerry Hunt, and then in turn subleased to the restaurant. So in addition to the income that he made from the restaurant, he personally, for the benefit of the community, is receiving every month very substantial land lease payments. The restaurant pays that company as part of the community estate. That's why the trial court in this case found that in large measure, the profits of Tony's restaurant were devoted by Tony to building up and adding to the community estate, because that's the fact and that's the truth. So the Attorney General opinion doesn't apply to this kind of case. But even so, the Attorney General himself said, it is said that if the husband is paid his salary to his service by the corporation, this reimburses the community for his time and labor and so on, and the corporation remains separate. That's from the Attorney General back in 1945. He doesn't cite very persuasive authority. He cites a couple of federal courts and corpus juris secundum, because I don't think there was very much other authority back then, nor is there today. I think based on this record that the trial court ought to be firm and the court of appeals to this.
I have nothing further unless the court has any questions. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. Do I understand you have something you wish to file?
Yes, I had a copy of the article just written in the public.
Is there objection in counsel?
No, sir.
All right. It'll be granted. Call now the case of ex parte William R. Hodges. Counsel, please come to the counsel.